Welcome to The Big Rich Show. This podcast will focus on conversations with friends and acquaintances within the four-wheel drive industry. Many of the people that I will be interviewing, you may know the name, you may know some of the history, but let's get in depth with these people and find out what truly makes them a four-wheel drive enthusiast. So now's the time to sit back, grab a cold one, and enjoy our conversation.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two, Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Why should you read Four Low Magazine? Because Four Low Magazine is about your lifestyle, the four-wheel drive adventure lifestyle that we all enjoy. Rock crawling, trail riding, event coverage, vehicle builds, and do-it-yourself tech all in a beautifully presented package. You won't find Four Low on the newsstand rack, so subscribe today and have it delivered to you. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, we have Chris Durham. Chris is an original rock crawling competitor, fab guy, magazine hero, and just generally an all-around great guy. One of my favorite competitors over the years. We're going to learn a little bit about Chris, hopefully a lot, what drove him into off-road and how he got to where he is today. So Chris, thank you for coming on with me and sharing your life and your history in off-road and rock crawling with our listeners. So let's get started. Tell me about growing up. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get started in off-road and your kind of your background?
So background, I lived in South Carolina pretty much my whole life other than traveling a lot over the years. Been very fortunate to go see a lot of places four-wheeling across the United States for various different entities. So basically, you know, it started out as kind of a hobby, turned into a profession. Still, it's still a very sought after hobby. It's not a profession per se, other than the work side of it now for me. So basically, you know, it's been, you know, self-employed shop owner for 20 years now and just kind of running through things that are. So the backdrop of that is, you know, my go back to the beginning. One of the things that put me into the off-road industry was when I was a kid. Well, my first vehicle, I had an option of buying a 55 Bel Air or a 79 Ford truck. And I opted for the Ford truck instead. And I often wonder where I would be at if I would have bought the 55 instead. So, you know, I know it'd be deep in the street rods, which I still have a somewhat of a street rod background and build some from time to time for people. But it's all modernization, you know, taking the old and making it new. So from that, you know, just as a teenager, I was trail riding some in a full-size truck and wasn't doing no rock crawling, but it was just trail rides and, you know, mud holes, because that was a thing when you're a kid and you see how dirty and muddy you can get. I learned real quick that it costs a lot of money to fix stuff with mud eats. So kind of ventured away from that and I will drive way out of the way to avoid a mud hole now. Although some of the videos out there don't show it that way, but that's because we had to go through them. But nowadays, you know, the only ones I'll get in is, you know, if we're one of the trips where it's, that's the only way to get through there, you know, and there's no bypasses. So, but I really don't like them at all.
Yeah. And Ultimate Adventure, they kind of look for that stuff, don't they?
They look for a variety, you know, and the biggest thing on Ultimate Adventure is there's a lot of places that has places to wheel, but it's either you have mountainous terrain and rock or you have mud holes. Some places you have both, but, you know, we cover such vast areas over the years. A lot of places, Florida, for example, is nothing but mud. But you got to, sooner or later, you got to go to every state. So yeah. In Florida, it was nothing but deep mud. That's just an example. Alaska was mud and more mud and more mud and more mud. But, you know, it's different. But it's a trip of a lifetime. It really is. You know, it was very fortunate to get involved in that after getting out of rock crawling and falling into that and being able to be a part of it as long as I have. It's been a real treat.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the beginning talk about that Ford pickup and what got you involved in automotive repair. I understand you went to school for automotive repair. And what kind of led you down that road?
So when I was in high school, I was actually, my dad's in construction work. So instead of taking carpentry in high school, in vocational school, I decided I wanted something different. I wanted to learn a new trade or learn something different, not go to school for what I already knew. So basically what I did is I took automotive. I decided on the automotive program so that I could work on my own vehicle. I want to be able to fix my own vehicle, you know. And a little bit of background, my grandfather had a shop and a junkyard back in the 60s and 70s up through the early 80s. So when I was a kid, I was in there, you know, a fair amount of time as well. So, and I just kind of took a liking to it, I guess. And biggest thing was I wanted to be able to fix my own vehicle. And if I wanted to modify it or upgrade it or just repair it, I wanted to be able to do it myself. So I went to vocational school, and the vocational schools had competitions between vocational schools, like throughout the year. Teacher put me in the class or in the competitions, and I won the upper state and state and got a full scholarship to local Greenville Technical College. So when I got out of high school, I had basically a full scholarship to go to Tech to a 2.5 year class. And then from there, I did the same thing. Was part of the competition class that traveled, went to the Nationals in Louisville, Kentucky. And, I did good throughout all that, and just kind of the automotive become a natural reflex to me. So from that, you know, I was working in dealerships and worked dealerships for a few years. And I realized that the dealership was not my deal. I didn't like it. So I wanted something different and got out of dealerships. And a friend of mine, his family owned an off-road shop. And when I was burnt out on dealership, I went to them and said, need to talk to you. And he's like, well, I need to talk to you too. I need some help. I said, I'm looking for a job. And it worked out that easy. Walked right in, worked there for a few years. Long story short, worked another shop for a couple of years and then decided that it was best that I just did it on my own. Left the shop I was in, built a small garage, rolled my toolbox in, started the first job, and have been behind ever since for 20 years now. Never had to wonder what I was going to do. It was always which one I was going to do next.
That's good to have that kind of business. You must have a good reputation in your area to be able to, you know, keep that kind of business going for over 20 years.
Yeah, it's never been an issue. And the biggest thing is, you know, if you treat people right, you do things right, you fix things the right way. You know, I've never, up until last year, I've never advertised anything in my life. Like I went for 10 years, didn't even have a business card. It's all by word of mouth. So that says a lot to be able to do that. And, you know, and in the last 20 years, we've had some hard times in the economy and different things. And I've never, you know, I've been very fortunate to not have any issues from it. Even now through this mess we're dealing with now, I'm as busy now or busier than I ever have been.
That's great. That's really good. And being able, you must have some employees that you can trust to be able to go take the time to go to Moab and for Easter Jeep. Of course, we couldn't do that this year, but to do that and to Ultimate Adventure and some of the other trips that you make, is that a key, or do you have to close the shop down?
Well, for years I just closed the shop, you know, because I was one man for a long time and I had part time help here and there. But for the last 10 years, I've had some good help and they've stuck in here and they've worked while I've been gone. And then I give them the same opportunity when I get back. If they want to go somewhere on a trip or, you know, the same amount of time, whatever, you know, they're welcome to go whenever they want, wherever, you know, and just I'm very easy because they help me. So the least I can do is help them.
That's good. Let's go into the off-road portion of that. You were trail riding in your Ford pickup. Obviously that vehicle's probably not on the road anymore.
No, it's been sitting in storage for a long time.
Oh, you still have it though?
The round to it list.
The round to it list.
Yeah. I have a very long round to it list. So the truck itself, while I was still driving it, I acquired my first CJ, CJ5. And I built one, what I thought was the right thing to build. And it was not the right thing to build for what we needed for actual trail riding. Listened to the wrong person when I built it, basically. So I went trail riding with some friends, realized what I needed, come back, bought another CJ and built it. Back then, the combination, perfect combination was a 35, 36 inch tire, radial tire, Daniel 44 front and rear, you know, six cylinder V8, whatever you decide for power plant. But that was a good combination. East Coast wheeling, we could go wherever we wanted to for the most part. And there's a lot of background to that as in why that combination works as well as it does. But then from there, I acquired several more vehicles and built some what we called cab trucks back in the day, or hybrids. We would take a full-size frame and a small cab and just put the cab on a, you know, say a Chevy Love cab or a Nissan cab onto a full-size Chevrolet Blazer frame. And all you had was just the cab and four wheels and the drivetrain. So you didn't have to worry about any body damage or tearing anything up. You could go wherever you wanted to. So at that point, we escalated from that, and I got back into another Jeep when I wanted to have windows and doors and something nice again. So I found a CJ10 that I actually built as an aircraft tug. And the aircraft tug was ugly, short, two-wheel drive, Nissan diesel. Had a transfer case in it that was mechanically held into low range, say, for pulling the planes around. So I canned the whole drivetrain and built custom axles for it, put a 258 six-cylinder in it, stretched wheelbase, all said and done, 110-inch wheelbase, and made a custom bed for it, and made it nice when it's all said and done before I went to Moab my first year, which is part of where I got started in the off-road, the rock crawling side of it years later. But so after building it, this group of us decided to go out west every year, went to Moab as a vacation, just a group of friends together for a vacation. So we decided that we wanted to go somewhere different every year after that. And we didn't know where to go. So I was talking to Pat Gramillion at Premier Power Welder back in the day from drove an orange Bronco, always in the magazines, always there. I was talking to him and asked him where to go. And he said to go to Farmington, New Mexico, plenty of places to ride, plenty of trails, all you wanted, and then some. And they had an event there. It'll be the first ARCA Goodyear rock crawling competition. So all of us signed up for the event. And after doing so, we got there. We wheeled all week ahead of time, signed up for the event, and told myself if I did good in the first one, I would continue to do the series. It was five that year, I believe, five or six. And so after doing so, first obstacle, I broke both front axles and was, you know, I'm over my head. I'm 20-something years old, young, and I ain't never done anything like that. And that's, you know, I just realized, I'm like, you know, I just throw the towel in. Well, this guy comes by, didn't know who he was at the time, but it's Phil Collard. He was a trail designer. And he come by and he says, asked me if I had the stuff to fix it with. I said, I've got the parts, but, you know, this is way more than what I bargained for. You know, it's over my head. He said, well, I've been watching you out here all week. He said, if you got the parts to fix it, fix it. You're capable of doing everything else out here the rest of the weekend. Just fix it if you got the parts. So we met a lot of people on that first event. And one of the guys that become friends, actually become my spotter years later, was Tim Donaldson. We didn't have a jack. So I told my spotter, I said, go find us a jack so we can fix it then. So Andrew's walking through the crowd of vehicles, and here's a high lift bolted to the back of somebody's Jeep, and he just takes it off. So we fix the Jeep, go back, and go to give him the jack back, and they didn't realize it was gone. Apologize to him, you know, hey, we stole your jack a while ago, but here it is. You know, wound up becoming friends with him, and like I say, years later, Tim actually become my spotter for a while. And escalated. We did, you know, I forget the exact numbers now because it's been so long ago, but I qualified in the top 15 out of 72, I believe it was, and finished in the top 15. I think it's ninth or vice versa, ninth, 12th, something of that nature. And so after that, I told myself if I did good in the first one, I'd continue the series. So from there, I think the next event was in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And we come out to it and did fairly well in it. And by the third event was Cedar City. We actually won the event at Cedar City. And from there, you know, we escalated. We bumped up to second in points behind John Curry. And then from there, you know, it was just it was a finish to the end to try to win the series. And that was kind of become a goal of mine for that year. And turned out it worked out. You know, we actually did win the series, the first ever. And so it just kind of it escalated on. And, you know, we met so many people along the way. And you can't say enough about the industry and the amount of people and their quality of nature in this industry is unreal.
I have to agree. The friendships that I've made in the 20 years plus that I've been involved with the sport and the industry has been incredible. The camaraderie, the helpfulness of everybody, you know, just our friendship. I only get to see you like once a year now when we see each other in Moab, but it's great to always be able to sit down and talk and see how everybody is doing. And, you know, one of the things that we're fortunate enough about is we travel and put on events. If we have a problem, you know, we break down or, you know, I need a part or something like that, just being able to get in onto social media and saying, hey, anybody nearby that can help. And it's amazing how many people will come out of the woodwork and even drive 4 hours or 5 hours to help. You know, that's, I don't think there's another industry where you can get help like that.
I agree with you on that. And I've had several friends of mine that drove that distance to get me off the side of the road when I was driving back in the day to, you know, the comps and stuff when transmissions break or, you know, truck breakdown, trailer, whatever, you know, over the years, that if you do it enough, there's going to be issues. But like you say, there's always somebody there that would lend a hand, give you their shop, you know, give you the tools, whatever you needed. Even if it's competing against you, they'd still give you the stuff they had, you know, to be able to continue on or whatever.
So, you know, this is the second try on getting this interview done. We had some technical difficulties in that first go around that we had. You talked about an experience with meeting Walker Evans. Tell that story again.
So at the one of the highlights, or not highlights, but one of the things that stands out in memory from Cedar City is after winning the event, was back at the motel parking lot, and, you know, we're standing around talking, what have you, and I look over and somebody's underneath my Jeep. There's two people underneath my Jeep, and I'm like, what are they doing under my Jeep? It's, you know, they're laying on the ground underneath my Jeep in the parking lot. And I'll go over there, and it's actually Walker Evans and Randy, his mechanic. And they're looking at it, and they're just looking because they're amazed at how something that old and ragged could work so well. And made a comment that, you know, told me, asked me if I knew the rear frame cross member was broke completely in two. And I told him, I said, well, if you look how many times it's been welded back together, I finally got tired of welding back together and just left it alone. And, you know, some people contribute that to, you know, it's frame flex, it's whatever, it's four wheel travel, it's however you want to call it. But I got tired of fixing it, and it worked after that. So, and still to this day, that CJ10, the frame cross member, is broke in the same place, and I still wheel it like it is.
So you never fixed it after that. You didn't upgrade it. You just left it. That's,
if it gets too bad, I'll weld it again, and, you know, it'll last for 6 months or so, and it'll break again. So it just, there's probably a 50-pound spool of wire holding that cross member in from over the years. Probably going in and holding the whole Jeep together, you know, as long as and hard of life as it's had. So it's had a lot of repairs.
So when I first met you, we didn't really get a chance to meet or be introduced, but that was that Cedar City event. But where I really got to know you, I feel, was at the first event I put on personally, and that was Put Up or Shut Up in Lake Amador, November of 2001. And you showed up as part of a team with Mike Harmuth and Ted and Renee LeBaron, and I think Danny Grimes was there as well, but it was pretty cool to have you guys come over from ARCA and compete at my first event. And one of the things that I remember about you at from that event was breaking a driveline and jumping out, replacing the driveline, and then trying to finish the course. First of all, you know, there's only 10-minute time limit on course, but you got that driveline replaced, and then you were trying to finish the course. And I don't remember, I know it was one of the late obstacles of the day, but you came really close to finishing that course, if not, maybe finishing the course. Do you remember that?
So that happened a couple times over the years. And, you know, for me, with the style of trail riding that I'd been through, my driving style, I broke several drive lines over the years on different reasons. You know, it was kind of a common breakage for me at the time. And being said, so the reason I was able to change it out so fast is because the wrench and the U-bolts sets that I needed to put back in case I needed anything was actually taped to the roll cage. So by the time I got seatbelt unhooked, I had the tools in my hand to repair the drive shaft, and the drive shaft was readily available as well. You know, bungee corded to the floor, you know, just basically quick and simple. So I could change the drive shaft out and still complete an obstacle. Like I said, I did that several times, you know, over the years. And it's probably, you know, so that a lot of it's got to be, you know, you got to be motivated, you got to be driven, you got to be good with your hands, and you got to think ahead and plan ahead. And the planning ahead was the biggest reason why I was able to do that, because I had everything I needed readily available within arm's reach. So that played a big part in being able to do that.
And that's great, because I see a lot of guys will have an issue on course and then just give up and say, you know, okay, I'll take my breakdown time if I can't make the next course, and we'll see if we can get it fixed or not. But from early on, I try to tell our drivers at driver's meeting, especially the new guys, you know, you have that 10 minutes that you're on course to do whatever you need to do to finish that course. And I always relate that story back to them about you at Amador replacing that drive line. So thank you for being good that way and giving me something to teach the new guys. With that, you competed for quite a few years. I know that you competed at ARCA. You competed at Cal Rocks with me. You competed at Pro Rock as well.
Yep.
I remember going to Johnson Valley. I think it was a master's course. And I had an event the next weekend or 2 weeks later from the weekend that I was there. And you guys were competing, and I think it was with Bob Hazel. In fact, I know it was with Bob Hazel. And we were all standing around while it was John Curry, you. I think Adam Dodds was actually spotting for you that weekend. There were some others that were there, and we're standing around, and somebody comes up to me, and because I was handing out flyers for my event at Bob Hazel's event. And I remember somebody from Bob Hazel's group came up and said, "Hey, you know, you can't hand out flyers for your event at this event." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not asking people to leave your event now. I'm asking them to come back to the area in 2 weeks. You know, why couldn't I do that?" Well, you didn't ask Bob. And I remember looking over, and Bob Hazel was standing about 40 feet away. And I yelled over and said, "Hey, Bob, can I hand out flyers?" And he looked at me and kind of shook his head and like, "All right, fine." But you guys were all standing there, so I felt like I had some backup, you know, to be able to ask that question. He ended up letting me hand out the flyers, and Bob and I always got along okay doing the events. I can't say that about all the other promoters, but we're all – the guys that I see now, we're all friends, whether it's Craig Stump or Ranch Pratt. I haven't seen Bob. Have you heard from Bob lately?
Nope, or, I've heard from Bob in years.
Yeah. That's what I've heard from a lot of guys. Anyway, we digress. Let's go to some of the guys that you competed against. See if you could tell us any stories that you remember, say, with Shoopy, with Ken Shoop. Anything that stands out in your mind?
The biggest thing with him is he's always wearing these swimming shorts, or what if you want to call it, swimming shorts or boxers or something. He never would dress appropriately, you know, everywhere he went. That's one of the biggest things that stands out about him. He always tried to be the center of attention. And still to this day, he's still the same person, loves to be the center of attention. He will do things and tell you later that he's done things. You know, certain things you just don't say that you've done, but he's that person that will tell you everything bad he's ever done in his life and laugh about it. But it was years ago, used to trail ride with Shoop all the time, and that's one of the ones that got me heavily involved with it. So we were in the year we were in Moab, they were doing a photo shoot on my CJ10. Ken was there on the same officer's own bump dump, but was actually to the right side of it on the big wall face, and they were taking photos of my Jeep, and Ken asked them, if I turn my Jeep over right here, right now, will y'all put it in the magazine? And they said, no, we won't do it. And so that really burned him up. So we get back home, and somehow or another, I heard different stories, but they were sitting outside with a paint gun, with a paintball gun, and shooting the side of the Jeep, and it had multicolor paintballs. So then he got the idea that he was going to paint his Jeep all these different colors, like Skittles colors, camo style. Painted it, clear coated it, whole nine yards. We were in Tennessee on one of Bob Hazel's runs, and I can't remember the guy's name. The photographer, it'll come to me in a little bit, was there doing an article, and he took a photo of Ken's Jeep on a waterfall and put it like full open spread page. And the caption said, you cannot lose this one in the mall parking lot. But he got his first shot in a magazine because of the Skittles paint job. And he had a few other theories of why he painted it like that I'm not going to say at this time. So, but yeah, it was very comical. Always a good time.
Let's talk some memories then about some of the other guys. How about Joel Randall?
So I run into him just a couple years ago somewhere on a trail ride. First time I'd seen him out in years. Joel was a good guy. He was very, you know, he did most of his own builds himself in his garage through the winter months, off season, you know, farmer, you know, when he wasn't farming, he was working on his Jeep and buggy. Super nice guy. I don't ever remember a bad thing about him, really. I mean, he was always there, always on time. Always just like he was a top notch guy.
Yeah.
And would help you and, you know, point you in any direction or whatever at any time.
A gentleman. Definitely, yeah. A gentleman.
Very much so. You could tell he was, you know, he had backcountry, his farming backcountry, and that sort of thing spoke a lot for his reactions and the way he acted and treated people, because he was from that era of people that treated people with respect.
Yep. How about Shannon Campbell?
So Shannon, I remember seeing Shannon Campbell in a magazine in Pinky. And we get there at the first event, and he's driving Pinky. And, you know, it's funny to me, the first article in the magazine to come out with us, you know, in the ARCA competition and everything, they had, and they actually printed this, and I don't think they actually caught it at the time. So the editor asked Shannon about this vehicle and what have you, and he told him he had what style locker was his Lincoln locker. And they wrote it out as Lincoln Locker in the magazine. It was welded spider gears, but they wrote it out as a Lincoln Locker in the magazine. I never will forget that. But yeah, Shannon drove the wheels off Pinky. He really did. And their background was racing their whole life anyway. So, you know, that was a good thing. You know, a good experience for me to meet him. And once I met him, I forget the event we was at somewhere, and we was going to do a ride in Phoenix. And I think I broke my transmission case, and he knew he had a transmission guy and invited me back to his shop. We pulled the transmission out, sent it out, had it fixed, come back, put it in. just so we go trail riding next weekend. You know, this, that's another, you know, that whole group stand up, you know, but they were willing to, they let me use their shop. They give me all the contacts. They helped me take the transmission out, put it back in just so I could go riding with them at next weekend. So that, that says a lot about their character, you know?
Yeah.
We had a lot of good times, a lot of good events. Enjoy that a lot.
How about Jason Pauly and the whole Twisted Customs team with his spotter was Travis, and then Travis's dad, George.
George, yep. So funny thing about Jason Pauly, I've not seen or talked to him. I've talked to him messages a few times, maybe once on the phone, since 2004, maybe. So it's been 15 years. And on Ultimate Adventure this year, we actually parked our truck and trailer at Jason Pauly's house. And got to see him again, and he's not changed. He's changed. You know, he's still the same old Jason he was. He just got a long beard now, and he's just doing his thing, working on race trucks. And you know, he's still living and chasing that dream. And hats off to him. But he is a phenomenal painter, and his artistic skills is like nobody else's I know. He is a vision of stuff that very few people have. You know, as far as being able to see. The creativeness that comes out of him is amazing.
One of his teammates is probably one of the most intense competitors I've had to deal with. And he's on my list of who to, of guys to interview as well. And that's Tracy Jordan. So what was it like competing against Tracy?
Tracy was, he always kept a very competitive edge. He did his best to stay on top, and he watched all the fine details. But when they started, you know, he was with some of the early crowd with rear steer, and I remember his original Land Cruiser with hydraulics on it. He could control each corner hydraulically, individually. So it was somewhere, actually at his house, because we was doing a trail ride for one of the magazines, Asylum Trail out of Phoenix, and he ordered pizza for everybody, and he talked to the delivery driver, played a joke on him, and told him that if he could drive his Land Cruiser down the road on three wheels, he'd get the pizza for free. They didn't know he had hydraulics on it. Pulled one rear wheel up in there and drove it down the highway and turned around to come back on three wheels and got free pizza. I mean, who would have thought it, but it worked.
That's pretty awesome. Let's see. What about Randy Torbett? Did you get a chance? You got a chance to compete against Randy, didn't you?
Yeah, I competed against Randy in the E-Rock series. I think the second year he was in the E-Rock. Randy was very, very patient. He never got in a hurry for anything. He had everything planned out in his head from the time this clock started to the time it stopped. He never got in a hurry, never got excited, very laid back. And he was actually a very good driver. And he came up with some things that, you know, probably put a lot of drive in the industry as far as he was using tractor equipment, better turning radiuses, you know. And I think he's probably some of the first ones that was putting the weights in their tires as well. He was doing that. He was in that crowd. So, you know, a lot of stuff he come up with was instrumental to the, in the beginning. And, you know, nobody knew who he was until after, you know, after the first year he competed, then everybody knew who he was. But he did things just so much finesse, you know, just like I say, never got in a hurry or excited about anything. He just drove.
What was, what were your thoughts the first time you saw the car Tiny?
That somebody, not knowing the backstory at the time, but looking at it, you know, somebody had plenty of time, effort, and money to build Tiny. And the concept was great. The lightweight was key. You know, that was the biggest thing, is just its sheer size and weight. But you had to have that much of a racing background to be able to build something like that and make it live. And that's something that a lot of us didn't have, was the actual racing background as to what they were accustomed to. So, you know, they were, at the time, they were way ahead of their game when they did that. You know, they created a whole new era of buggies by doing that. but they thought outside the box and they made it work, which is good. It was a game changer for sure. The downside to it is it took the reality of normal looking vehicles and went to buggy. That was the buggy turning point.
And that was early. You know, that's what amazed me, is it happened very early. In fact, I don't know if you know the story, but John Bundrant, when he competed that first season event we did down in outside of Lucerne Valley at Lions Pride Park, John was competing in his Toyota Truggy, and John Nelson was there watching. He'd convinced Nelson to come out and watch. John had done a breakover, landed on the frame really hard, and broken his back, similar to what you had done later on. And he had some time off from the event to heal, and that's when they started working on Tiny, because Nelson was like, well, let's figure this stuff out, and basically put a seat on a milk crate and said, okay, let's design a buggy around where you sit. And they used, from what John said, Bundrant said, is that they used the basics of the Truggy width and length wheelbase to design Tiny, but to make it, you know, specifically a buggy instead of, you know, taking a regular vehicle and modifying it. Right. And he was definitely a game changer. Definitely a game changer. So what was the, what event do you remember the most? What, besides being, say, the first event that you went to, what event over the years, competitive event, stands out most in your mind and why?
Probably one of the biggest ones in my mind at this time would be the last event, first series of ARCA. You know, that's one of the big, I guess, big points in my time was, you know, having the opportunity to win the first ever series. You know, that was a game changer for me, and the fact of the things I could do from there and opportunity doors that opened for me. If we would have had social media back then, like what we do now, it would have been tenfold. We would have progressed so much faster, you know, with having the ability to get knowledge out to people that what we're actually doing. We're, instead of just, you know, X amount of prints in the magazine and video, you know, we could actually have put, it would have come on the map a lot faster, and it would have helped more teams to be able to afford to progress, you know, with the tinies and stuff like that. You know, it would have helped a lot more people out. But just the fact of, you know, me being, and I don't remember the age I was at the time, but, you know, me being that young from East Coast, going out to West Coast with all these people that, you know, for years I saw in a magazine, and then I've become friends with a lot of them, and, you know, competing against them and actually winning the series, that was just, you know, that was I guess you'd say like a top of a totem pole. You figure somebody that's, you know, in early 20s to accomplish a goal like that with nothing really, you know, I didn't have nothing high tech, still leaf springs, still carbureted, you know, didn't have nothing, you know, but to make that goal was a big deal for me.
Was Moose spotting you at that point?
Yes. That was the fourth event that he spotted for me. So Andrew spotted the first one and Moose spotted the next four.
Have you seen Moose lately, or what's that?
Yeah, saw him last week.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, next time you see him, tell him I said hello.
I will. Yeah, he lives about 15 minutes away.
Cool.
So I see him on a regular basis.
Well, we're going to be doing a tour this off season, and our goal is to stay close or below I-40, Interstate 40. I'm going to try to get into your area, South Carolina, and come by and say hello. So
sure.
When I do that, I get to, maybe we can put together a barbecue or something like that and get some of those guys that I haven't seen in years to come on by so that we can all say hello. That would be awesome.
We can make it happen.
That would be great. So what kind of things are you doing now besides just repair? I know that you have your Chris Durham Motorsports. I know that you've created some different body panels and front ends and stuff like that. You've gone to the low slung big tire, you know, the look I've always liked. Instead of building them tall, you've kept them low. So let's talk about that, where your mindset was on that, and what kind of products that you offer.
So in the beginning, I learned, you know, low center of gravity was key. You know, that was some real early knowledge, you know, from the competition side. I learned how valuable that was. So then after building a few vehicles, and I started building TJs for myself and for customers, and I come up with a formula. Basically, I made a hood was the biggest key. So when we were doing the competitions, the rules, I don't remember if it was yours or ARCA one, the rules were 48-inch wide body minimum, and you had to have a fender that was 4 inches wide minimum. So I combined the hood and fender into one piece so that we had all the tire clearance we needed and we could keep that low center of gravity. So in doing that, that allowed us to set the platform for the next 15 years of LCG builds. Because with just a hood, on a TJ, you gain 7 inches of ground clearance or tire clearance just by cutting the fenders and putting the hood on. So that's equivalent to a 7-inch lift. Same scenario. So in doing it, I progressed, you know, I've been selling those hoods for over 20 years now, and I progressed and made several different models. And then I started making conversions and that sort of thing. So now it's, you know, I don't know the exact number of different molds and parts I have with it, but anything from your typical CJ, YJ, TJ hood, standard width. Then I have narrowed hoods for buggies. I have cowls, grills, and various things. And I made a few years ago, I had a Gladiator grill hanging on a wall, been hanging on a wall for years. And I just decided one day that I was going to put that Gladiator grill in the front of a JK. And that was going to be my next build. So I literally went and bought a JK, brought it in the shop, and took a Wagoneer front clip and hood and started cutting it down and migrated two together. And my goal was it was going to maintain the stock Gladiator grill insert. And it does maintain the stock Gladiator grill insert. So now I have that conversion, and it's 7 to 18 JK, and I should next few weeks have the JL kit finished up that'll fit on the Gladiator, which they actually should have built to begin with. Calling it a Gladiator, it should actually look like one. This past year, 2 years ago, I built my blue Gladiator pickup before they come out with theirs, just to showcase what they could have done in comparison to what they did. If you meet a regular Gladiator going down the road, it don't stand out. It looks like a regular JL. You can't tell when you pass it. So this way, with my grill conversion, you can tell there's something different. You won't lose it. It won't blend in nowhere. It's going to stand out. But on top of that, I do several others. Like I just did one for the Ultimate Adventure rig this year. They wanted an MB grill to a TJ or an LJ. So that I made them a custom hood to use an MB grill to a TJ cowl. So now I've got a hood available. It's got flat fenders. It looks like a flat fender style hood. I put a 1-inch radius lip on top of the hood to match the flat fender theory. Wow. So a couple of years ago, I did one for, I was sitting down at dinner with some people from Warren, and they were trying to figure out for their 70th anniversary what they were going to do for Warren, for their vehicle for that year and for your Ultimate Adventure. And literally we sat there at dinner and discussed it, and they said they wanted a scrambler, but they wanted a TJ. So they looked at me and said, can you make a hood go from a TJ to a CJ? I'm like, and how much time we got to do this? It was literally a short period of time. So I made a hood to go from a CJ to a TJ. So it's just adding to the variety over the years, you know, and different conversions and such. I've got several more in the works. I've got a bunch more. I just come out with a new TJ hood. Kind of, I took my JK hood with a Ram Air style setup and converted it over to a TJ. So now I have a new Highline hood for a TJ with a Ram Air. And also, I should have done a long time ago, I actually made two versions of a Highline hood to fit steel fenders or aftermarket fenders. So now I have a bolt-on Highline hood available for a TJ as well. That's, you know, everybody's, instead of every cut your own down and all that. Now I actually have one that'll bolt on with it. So that's another thing I've been working on to get it finished up. But, you know, the builds over the years, that's what kind of drove the builds of that, of the TJ Highline hood. And then I learned that, you know, building a new one all the time and keeping it fresh, number one, it don't break down because everything's still new. So you can you get more enjoyment out of it. And then two, you know, it just, it keeps the different appearance up there. It keeps people looking at it, keeps people interested in it, you know, the, what's next, what's going to be next. So it's just each year I try to step it up and build something different every year to get people's attention to say, you know, one of these days I want to do that. You know, that's to keep people in the industry driven to be creative. There's a group of us that does that, you know, that keeps people imagination going, you know, one of these days I want to do this. One of these days I want to do that. I want to do mine like that. There's so many options. So the more you see of stuff, the more options you have of doing. And it's people like me in the industry that, that make things like it happen. To give you that option of, you know, I can do this or I can do this, or there's 10 other things you can do. But it takes people driven in the industry to make that happen.
I agree. I really have enjoyed your builds over the year, over the years. One of the highlights of Easter Jeep is always seeing what you're going to show up with. When Danny's, that chair that you built, the rocking chair for Danny, that was off the hook.
That was a good time.
So that was, for people that have never seen it, if you're in Moab during Easter Jeep Safari, if and when they allow us to do it again, stop by Grandpa's garage, and it sits out in his backyard in front of his shop. I was just there a few weeks ago and visiting, social distancing visiting. That chair is just phenomenal. You know, just to come up with an idea like that, that's what you do with the cars as well. And it's always appreciated. I know that there's a lot of people out there that look forward to seeing what you're bringing to Easter every year, like I do. So what is on the agenda for Chris over the next couple of years, besides some innovation with some new hoods and stuff? Is there anything else that you're looking to do or accomplish?
I mean, not really at this time. You know, it's just one of those things where I'm to the point now where I just try to do as much as I can and still have as much enjoyment as I can. So, you know, I got a message today from a guy from South Dakota that's going to Harlan, Kentucky in 2 weeks, in the middle of the week. He's like, can you make it up? Well, yeah, I can. You know, that's going to be my option because I'm to the point where, you know, yeah, I work hard enough and my, you know, I'll work over the weekends if I have to make that time up to be, or when I get the opportunity to go somewhere, I'm going to go, you know, just to have the ability to be able to leave when you want to go do that is I'm very, very blessed with having an opportunity, you know, very fortunate.
I feel the same way with the way we've designed our life and having an off season, being able to travel between seasons, not only traveling for the season, but then now traveling in the off season and being able to go visit people has been great. A couple of years ago, we did the northern route and went up through South Dakota, across Washington and Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, South Dakota, and into Minneapolis, and then dropped down to Indiana. And we got to see so many people into Kentucky. Looking forward to doing that same thing this off season. So I understand that being able to have a business and have some flexibility to be able to do what you want instead of always having to worry about 9 to 5, you know, is it, to me, it's paramount. It's part of why we get into the business that we do, so that we can enjoy the lifestyle.
It's been a hard year this year for that, because we've not been able to go anywhere. So what it's turned me into this year, up until I went on Open Adventure, I literally worked 7 days a week for 8 months straight, because we couldn't go anywhere, we couldn't do anything, and I got to be doing something. So I just poured my time into the shop, and then when time came to go on Open Adventure, I was gone 16 days. But if you do the math on how many weekends I worked in that 8 months, that 16 days ain't nothing. No. So if I get any opportunities from now until the end of the year, I'm going to take those opportunities and go, just because of the simple fact I put in my time this year. You know, I've worked my overtime. So it don't bother me. You know, people say, people always ask me, well, how do you travel so much? How do you go so much? Because I work 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that when time comes for me to go, I can just go. If you really want to do something in life, you just got to be motivated and don't sit at home, watch TV, be out in the garage working on your stuff or work overtime to pay somebody to work on it. Well, however you got to do it. But that's what gets you where you want to be in life, is that motivation and drive. You just got to want to do it.
I agree. So do you take in interns to work in the shop to teach somebody what to do? Have you ever had that opportunity, or is it something that you've tried to avoid?
I have. I've had several people over the years that I wouldn't say necessarily interns as much as people that was employees that wanted to learn, you know, and that goes a long ways. If I, you know, I've had several guys that, one in particular that I really miss him not being here anymore because he moved back up north with his family. But he, anytime he wanted to learn something, I learned right off the bat, it's if he was willing to learn and he would learn it. You know, had a buggy to build one time and started on. He asked me what I was doing to it. And I explained to him everything had to be done. He asked me, he said, "You mind if I do it?" I'm like, that's what you want to do. That's fine. I don't care, you know? And he said, "Well, come here and show me how to use a tubing bender. I don't know how to bend tubing." And literally I showed him the foolproof way of bending tubing, and he started bending tubing and built the whole buggy himself. I mean, I pointed him, you know, what needed to be done and all, but he did all the tubing and fitment and everything just by himself, mainly.
That's awesome. That's great drive for somebody to want to learn like that. What do you, what's your newest project? I know, every year you've got something that you're building that's different. Do you have something on the burner right now?
I have not started on anything yet.
Wait until 2 weeks before Easter.
Well, so this year on Ultimate Adventure, it was kind of an epic year for me because I actually had, four vehicles that was driven on Ultimate Adventure this year that I personally built, and had three more there that I had influence on or had my product on it. You know, while they were building it, called me up, "Hey, how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I make this work?" So, you know, basically having those four, and two of those four actually just got finished right before we left. So I've been working trying to get those built so that we could go on the trip. So one of the readers that got in this year was in a van. It's a good buddy of mine. He's helped me for years. And we literally took photos of the van in the shop while we were building it. We submitted his application. And he got in. Like, we had to go out and take more photos to send to him to prove that it was drivable and capable before they would give the final approval on it. Because every photo we sent, it was sitting in the shop while we were working on it.
They should have been able to trust that you were going to get it done.
The funny thing about that is so when Christian called Travis on the phone to interview him, he asked him, because our voices, you got to be similar because we're from the South here and all. And Christian asked him two or three times, "Are you sure this ain't Chris trying to punk me?" Because, I mean, like, it sounds too good to be true, you know, but at the same time. So that was a joking conversation from there. But, yeah, they knew, you know, that it would be done in time. There was no question on that.
Do you don't get advance notice where they're going to go the next year, do you?
No. Me being a crony, I will find out a region it's going to be in. But, like, they didn't know – they generally don't know where it's going to be at until about 2 or 3 months before it happens.
Oh, okay.
Themselves. I get a heads up usually on the region it's going to be in, or like a location for planning, because, you know, for the cronies that do it, you know, that comes out of our pocket. You know, that's something that we do it for the love of it. And right. A lot of people don't know that, but we, you know, that's like, we buy our own fuel to get there, our own food to get there, the whole nine yards. You know, it's out of our pocket, but it's our vacation. But look at the places that we've been over the years that I never would go. I mean, there's no way I would drive to Kalispell, Montana for anything other than old adventure. You know, that gave me a reason to drive there. And then it's like a family reunion for some of us, because that's the only time we see each other, is that one time every year. So it's another group family that comes together, and that group is the same as like the rock crawling days. The guys, the backbone of the industry is the same guys, same attitude, same 9 yards. So it's a different group, but it's the same thing. It's a good group. You know, they'll do anything for you. Don't leave nobody behind. You know, it's a good deal. I recommend everybody to send in an application for that.
So there's one thing I want to touch on, and I don't know if it's something that you want to discuss or not, but the last competitive event that I believe that you were in was one of our We Rock events there in the Badlands. You had what I would call a pretty horrific crash on a line that I thought nobody would take, but you were the first one on it and knew that if anybody was going to do it, it was going to be the first guy that tried it. Do you want to talk about that? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, I remember it every day. Yeah, it was at the point in time on the competition side of it, things had gotten so competitive that if you didn't make one bonus line, you know, you would be out fifth or back. You had to hit every bonus line, you had to make every climb, you had to make every turn. You know, you really, everything got so competitive that you had to be on top of your game. And it was first event of the year, first obstacle, and I was first in line. And there was a bonus climb there that was, you know, one of them, it was there, so we had to try it. And I don't know exactly what happened. It happened so fast. I really don't know the full detail on it. But basically, now it's a big deal to cut a backflip in a monster truck and a motorcycle and a snowmobile and all. Well, I'm not going to say fortunate, but I did it back then, and doing so compressed my spine and broke my back and neck. And that was the last event I did. The year before that was the full year, and I did 28 events the year before that. And I had everything set up that year that I was actually going to be able to pick and choose what events I wanted to do. Was not going to run a complete series with anybody. I had everybody on board to let me do it my way that year. And, you know, unfortunately that happened. I still finished at the race that weekend. I think I finished fifth that weekend, painfully, but I finished it. And, you know, it was a life-changing experience for me. You know, it put me out of that side of it anymore, but at the same time, it put me from doing the competition stuff, which I was gone half the year, and it's hard to run a business when you're gone that much, to put me back here working and open a door for me to get involved in other stuff. I went back to trail riding more instead of competitions. I started doing Ultimate Adventure. I started spending more time going back to grassroots. And that, for me, was where I really wanted to be anyway. I just didn't realize how caught up I'd gotten in the racing side of it. Chasing that racing dream, you know, it cost me a lot of years. But at the same time, I wouldn't take nothing for it. But now that I'm back to, you know, the grassroots feeling, yeah, I mean, I'm content with it. Because I do get to go on, you know, Ultimate Adventure and JKX and JLX and Moab and Daytona and all these places, all these events I get to go to. So that's my fill-in for what I lost then. I'm still doing it, just at a different level.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I have always beat myself up over that obstacle and that bonus. I really thought that when I saw what I think it was my son that had set that obstacle, and I was like, you know, man, I don't know about that one. You know, he goes, oh, nobody will probably go for it anyway. And then I saw you line up for it, and I was like, oh, Jesus, here we go. So I apologize that was there, and, you know, it ended up being the way it was. But I'm glad that some good has come out of that for you. You know, but I'm sorry. I remember coming by and seeing you when you had the back brace and everything, and we had lunch together, and man, yeah, that seeing you in that back brace almost put me in tears, because you know, I hated to see somebody hurt like that. It has made me design courses differently, thinking about the ultimate outcome if there is, if somebody doesn't complete or if things go bad, what happens? So, you know, that whole thing got me to change how we do things. And, but I'm still sorry that it happened to you. Just wanted to let you know that.
Oh yeah. No worries.
So with that, I'd like to say thank you for joining us and being part of the history and being a friend over the years. I know that we had some conversations. There was one that I remember up at Donner, and first day didn't go your way. And you came, we were sitting there up at the, near the bar restaurant area. And you said, or may have been in the motorhome, I don't remember, but you said, you know, Rich, I don't know, maybe the sport's gone past me. I don't know if I'll ever win again. And I said, Chris, you'll be fine. Just be Chris, drive the way you've always driven and things will happen. And that event, you ended up winning. You, on the second day, you came back, had a great day and ended up winning the event. And I always thought, you know, God, I hope what we talked about that afternoon after the first day of competition helped get you to that point you needed to that day, the next day to win that. So I've always appreciated the drivers that I could have conversations with that, like that with, and you've been one of those from day one. And I just want to say thank you for all that you've done for the sport and, you know, what you've done for me personally running We Rock and Cal Rock. So thank you.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, you take care. And this off season, I plan on swinging by the shop and saying hello, but I'll let you know before we show up so we can plan a barbecue or something. And
we'll make it happen. I'll call in everybody.
That sounds great. Chris, thank you for your time. I know it's real late on the East Coast. I'm sitting here in California and you're in South Carolina, and we're, you know, you're at, it's about 10:30, 11 o'clock now. So thank you for taking the time. Have a great one.
All right. You do the same.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care. If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a rating. Share some feedback with us via Facebook or Instagram, and share our link among your friends who might be like-minded. Well, that brings this episode to an end. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next week with Conversations with Big Rich. Thank you very much.